Good morning. It's Saturday, December 27th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM-LP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Charles Barish, writer of poetry and crossword puzzles. A linguistics instructor and a poet in the schools, Charlie Barish has published poems in many literary and general interest magazines, as well as in the anthology, Baseball, I Gave You All the Best Years of My Life. Barish is a speech-language pathologist working with children from preschool through high school. With a broad background including everything from Romano-British archaeology to numismatics to local politics, Barish has also created crossword puzzles that have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Washington Post. He has a radio background as well, having hosted the oldies show Finger Pop in Time on WNCS from 1979 to 1987. When I spoke to Charlie in early December, I asked him to talk about the inspiration for his recent book of poetry, Dreams of the Presidents.
About 10 or 12 years ago, I think it was, I had this image in my head of Richard Nixon wrestling Bobo Brazil. And I don't know where it came from. All I can think of is that, all I can imagine is that it had something to do with B.B. Rebozo. Richard Nixon's friend, B.B. Rebozo, and somehow I got the name
Bobo
Brazil from that, yeah. And so I had this image of them wrestling, and I said, that would be an interesting thing to write about. So I wrote this poem with Richard Nixon wrestling with Bobo Brazil. And I finished that poem, and I said, wow, that was fun. And I said, I could do this for all the presidents. I hadn't planned it or anything like that, but I said, I could do this for all the presidents. And I did.
And so what year was that again?
I'm guessing it was probably about 1996 or so.
And is that version of Richard Nixon's dream the one that shows up in this book?
Or basically. Everything's been revised many, many times. Every time I look at a poem, I can't help revising it. In fact, I've already revised some of the poems. When I give a reading, I sometimes... There's a couple of poems that I read differently from what they're in the book because I can't help revising.
Yeah.
But it's basically the same dream that I first wrote down.
Okay. The poems, they deal with history and legend, and they also sort of delve into possible dreams that the presidents might have had. Mm-hmm. Did you have to work hard in order to find a nice balance for the history and the mythology and the imaginative sections, or did it all just kind of flow naturally?
It all kind of flowed naturally. I started off with history. I started off with each president, there was something true, something that I, well, maybe not with Richard Nixon, but basically I knew something about each president. And especially for the older presidents, not older in age, but the ones from the 19th century and early 20th century, I basically knew them as historical figures, so I would have some kind of historical fact that I knew about them, like William Henry Harrison had the shortest term of any president. I knew William Taft was the first president to throw out a baseball on opening day. I knew James Buchanan was the only bachelor president. So I had these little facts that I knew, and then from there, I would basically start off with something I knew, and then I'd do a little research and find out some of the historical events that happened during that presidency. And then I just start letting my imagination go and build a dream. When I say build a dream, you don't build a dream. Dreams happen.
Mm-hmm.
And with the president or with us. So it really works well for poetry, because with poetry, I don't think you build a poem either. I think they just happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I write a poem, if I know where I'm going, if I think I know where I'm going, it doesn't work. But if I just let the poem happen, it will work, or hopefully it works. And the same thing with these dreams. Like any dream, you don't know where they're going, and one thing leads to another, and there's all these shifts and images lead to, one image leads to something else that's maybe a little bit connected, but it's not quite connected in real life, just like in any dream. So I think I just start off with some history and then just see what happens.
Right. I enjoyed the balance of all these things. I was curious if you're a history buff by nature.
Well, I'm not a historian, but I've always been interested in history.
Right. But it sounds like it was the poetry that got you started rather than the history that got you started.
Yeah. How
did you approach the research? Did you sort of, one president at a time, read about their lives and times, or...
The research really wasn't a big part of the writing, although for some of the presidents I had to do more or less research, but I didn't want to learn too much about them. I mean, I didn't need to, not that I wouldn't like to know more about them, but I didn't need to know every fact about them, but I wanted to know something about them. But I guess some of the presidents, I just looked them up in the World Book Encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
And found a few interesting facts about their lives, their especially their family and close friends, wives and children and so on.
Right. So you didn't have to read a biography of each president.
I didn't read a biography of each president. I read some biographies. I read a biography of John Adams. I read a biography of William McKinley.
Uh-huh.
And they were fun. Some of them I just thought I'd skim through and find out some facts. I actually ended up reading the whole biography, but
because it was interesting.
Because it was interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed reading things that I hadn't known or things that I had forgotten about. You mentioned Harrison, and I forgot that the reason he had the shortest term was because of his inaugural speech.
Out in the rain.
He got pneumonia, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I enjoyed the notes that you put in after each poem, just sort of explaining. Was that something that you decided to do, or did your publisher
I decided to do that. I didn't do it originally. I added them the notes later. But... hopefully the poems will stand on their own as poems, but I realized there were facts in each poem, that details in each poem, or many of the poems, that were probably obscure to people, and obscure to me even. Some things like I had heard of, like the XYZ affair, mm-hmm. and 5440 or fight. These are things that I had heard about when I was in high school or something, and I had no idea what they really referred to anymore.
Right.
And... but I thought they were neat to put in the poems and references to them in the poems, but I realized that people wouldn't know, might be like me and not know what, they might have heard of them but not know what they really were.
Right.
So I added that in the notes. I gave explanations of those references, and I also explained references to other historical events that happened during the presidents, during each presidency.
Yeah. And I there were also little things that no one probably would have known. I didn't know, for example, that Grant smoked 2,000 cigars in a year.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Where did you find that out?
Oh, I saw that in several places. He was a big cigar smoker, and I didn't know that either.
I mean, he's always got a cigar in every picture, but I'm 2,000 a year.
I know. I didn't. Well, that's only about six a day or so.
Okay.
But it's a lot. And it led to his death, I think. I think that's what he died from.
Right, because he had throat cancer.
I think he did, yeah.
I also think of a cigar as harder to get through than a cigarette, so
yeah.
Six a day.
Yeah. And there's another interesting fact. Not many people know that Alexander Graham Bell tried to get the bullet out of James Garfield.
Yeah, I didn't know that until.
I didn't know that, but I found that out, and I said that's neat. And I think that was what got me. That was like the hook in the Garfield poem.
Yeah. And so we'll just explain it here. So he had some sort of device for finding a bullet, and he tried to find the bullet within the president's body.
Yeah.
And failed.
He failed because. The White House had also just installed new beds with springs in them.
Like a metal detector.
But actually, that's kind of points out how I would start a dream. Some of the presidents about whom I knew very little, I just find an interesting fact, and somehow I just get an image and just go from there and see what happens.
Yeah. I'm sure it was really fun as a poet.
It was a lot of fun to write
these. Plus, it gave you a certain level of direction without having everything all figured out, like
right.
you say.
Right.
On the back flap of Dreams of the Presidents, David Budbill describes these poems as funny, touching, painful and honest. And they do cover an array of attitudes and emotional styles. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious if you ever decided that you had gone overboard, maybe comically or critically, and decide to kind of scale back on the way you're depicting a certain president.
I don't think so. I think I don't think I was too critical of any of them, really.
Well, I mean, in your revision process, did you change anything because, for example, you know?
I didn't. And the funnier, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, not that they're all humorous, but I think dreams are outlandish, I don't think there are any that are really full of buffoonery or anything like that. I think they're as outlandish as real dreams are.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was afraid that was going to happen with. With the last president, George W. Bush, he was the last dream that I wrote. His was the last dream that I wrote, and I was afraid that I was going to be too critical of him. I was afraid that I was going to... I didn't know what to write. He was really hard because I was afraid that that I would make him seem like a buffoon or I'd be too critical. And actually, what I ended up writing was surprised me because I didn't know where it was going to go, and I was surprised by, I actually felt sorry for him after I wrote his dream.
Hmm. And there's also a part of his dream that reflects the serious nature of the outcome of his presidency with the war. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that made a lot of sense not to make him into a buffoon because it's not funny.
No, it's not.
This might be a good time for you to read something from your work.
Okay. Well, I'll read George W. Bush. This is the last dream in the book, but I'm going to, of course, the most recent, our current president, but I'm going to read this one first because we just talked about it.
This is Charlie Barish reading from Dreams of the Presidents, which is published by North Atlantic Books.
George W. Bush's dream. Air Force One takes off, banks low between buildings, down alleyways, through tunnels, stretching and bending impossibly, like in a cartoon. I'm having fun, but see, there's no pilot, and climb over mounds of naked bodies, severed heads. I'm afraid I'll be sucked under, but crawl to the cockpit and grab the wheel. I realize I don't know how to fly, and when the White House looms ahead, I wish my father were here. Mm. And I had no idea what was going to happen when I wrote his dream. I just had this image of the plane, him being in a plane, and it's kind of silly in the beginning of it stretching and bending like in a cartoon. Actually, that's a dream that I think I've had in the past, with the plane, being in an airplane, going through alleyways and so on. So I had that image from my own dreams. But then when I finished the poem, I really felt sorry for him, well, that he was in over his head.
Yeah. Do you want to maybe do one more?
Sure. Let me read. People ask me if they say to me. You wrote a poem for every president, and I say, yeah, and they say, did you really do Millard Fillmore? And I say, yeah, and they kind of laugh. I guess he's the most obscure president there is, maybe. Several people have said, did you really do Millard Fillmore? So I'll read you Millard Fillmore's dream. As it says in the notes, I'll tell you a little bit about Millard Fillmore, not too much, but he became president after the... death of Zachary Taylor. He was vice president, and he grew up on a farm in upstate New York, but he made concessions to the South in hope of preserving the Union, and he supported the Compromise of 1850, including the Fugitive Slave Act, which required runaway slaves to be returned mm-hmm. from anywhere in the U.S. So I'll read you Millard Fillmore's dream. Overhead, brilliant stars. Evening has cooled, but sweat soaks my shirt. All day I've run with Harriet Tubman north along the river. I reach high and grab the Big Dipper, wrench it from the sky, plunge a battered tin ladle into the river. I give Harriet a drink, then lean back, pour water over my face, down my throat. We fall asleep under brush but wake in bed, bodies pressed close against morning chill. It is the farmhouse where I grew up. A dog barks, lunges, my childhood hound held tight on a lead by my father. At the river, a bargeman counts coins into my father's hand, herds Harriet and me on board. We are enchained with dozens of men and women, runaway slaves. Each of our shirts bears a large scarlet S. Mm. And the scarlet letter was published during his presidency also.
That's great.
Thanks.
In the foreword of this book, John R. Turner makes the statement, in America we mythologize presidents. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you didn't write that, but it's in your book, and I wonder if you could talk about that statement and what it meant to you when he wrote that.
Interesting. I think it's true, because I didn't even connect what I'm thinking with what John wrote in his foreword, but so several people have asked me, have you written one about Obama yet?
That's one of my questions.
Okay, and they've asked me, when are you going to write one about Obama? And I say, my reaction is, well, there hasn't been a myth has to develop about him. We have to see what, it's not just writing about the history of the person or the history of the president of his term or who the person was, but I think there is a myth about each president that gets incorporated into these dreams. George Washington being the father of our country, and Teddy Roosevelt being the Rough Rider, and I think it's an easy kind of an easy way to categorize each president, mm-hmm. without really looking at them as a person. And I think, although I did try to look at them as people, I think the myths get incorporated into the poems. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt comes out almost bigger than life, and when he's in his dream, and William Taft, who followed him, comes out. He was the biggest president, and he comes out as kind of a hero as heroic in his dream. Well, Jefferson, of course, has his affair with Sally Hemings, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so there's certain images that are part of the presidential myth. Obama does come with a kind of a myth of kind of being like a savior. And for those of us who lived through the Civil Rights Movement and worked with the Civil Rights Movement, he's such a hero. And so there is some mythology attached to Barack Obama already, but I think I'm not ready to write the poem for him, but I certainly will.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the poem that could be written about what he's achieved just by being elected, but yeah. It's not about a president yet, is it?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite president?
A favorite president? I don't know a favorite poem, but my favorite president is probably Lincoln.
Lincoln.
I mean, it's not a very adventurous choice. He's almost a lot of people's favorite president. But
I think, yeah.
I think he was a great president.
Mm-hmm. And is that your favorite poem?
I don't know if it's my favorite. I don't know if I have a favorite poem. So I don't have a favorite poem, but Lincoln's poem I like. Yeah.
I would love it if you'd read it. That would
okay.
Be.
Abraham Lincoln's dream. Dancing women circle about a handsome young man, leap and linger in midair like bounding fawns, white dresses set aglow by sunshine, loose constellations of flowers streaming from their hair. Abraham, one of the women whispers as she dances past. He reaches a large hand toward the circle, and she comes round and touches it, then dances away with the other women, the circle spreading into the distance, each dancer now a tiny point of light, then a bright spark, gone in an instant like a dying star. The young hand has become lined. It is my hand, and I am afraid it will disappear. My head and feet will fly off. My body will let go its arms, its legs. The woman who spoke to me returns. She's Mary, and hands me Edward, our young son. I carry him swaddled up a mountain and raise him overhead, an offering, and again feel my arms about to let loose. I imagine them floating, bringing Edward to the heavens. I lower my arms, and I'm an old man, head bowed. Now Edward is General Lee. He kneels before me, says he will be the sacrifice. He will keep me from coming apart.
I loved the analogy to the biblical story of Abraham. And the other thing that struck me about that poem and a number of these poems was the fragility of life, mm-hmm. and how many of these presidents lost children.
Yeah.
That seemed like a sort of personal poem, you know.
I know what you mean. When I wrote this poem, this is different from this poem is stands out to me as different from almost every other poem in the book. Where in the beginning, most of the poems, I think, at least fairly early in the poem, have some sort of historical fact referenced. Mm-hmm. And this poem starts off ethereal with the women dancing about him, and I don't know where that image came from. I really don't. I started writing this poem, and I just had this vision of almost like Abraham Lincoln in a different... all the other presidents are in this one pantheon, and Abraham Lincoln is a different kind of god almost. And he has this very surreal vision of these women dancing about him, and one of them happens to be his wife. But there wasn't anything historical in the dream until near the end, when we meet his son, and we have General Lee in there. Mm-hmm. But this poem really felt different to me. And I don't know where that image came from, except that I think he was the greatest president, so maybe I have him separately from the other presidents. But as far as getting back to the fragility of life, I noticed that a lot of the poems, well, that's what people write about in poetry anyway, mm-hmm. things about life and death, and it's not just silliness. Even when you write a silly poem, it really is about bigger things, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And the presidents are like everyone else. They suffered deaths of their children, their wives. They had fears. They had unfulfilled desires. Mm-hmm. And they were in interesting positions, because they had all this power as president, and yet in their own lives they're as powerless as anyone else. So there's this weird feeling in them. How come if I have so much power,
I can't fix this.
Yeah. I can't fix either the world, and they have a failed presidency like George W. Bush, or they can't fix their own lives. They have the same fears as everyone else, same problems like U.S. Grant, as you mentioned, with all the cigars and drinking, and he had his own private issues. And the other thing about them is they have to be a little nuts to want to be president, I think. They have to have... and just the whole process of deciding you want to be president, I think you're giving up your own private life, and you think that you're going to be better. For some reason, you think that you can be better than anyone else at doing this job. And
right. It has to be. You have to have a little bit of an ego there, don't you?
You have to have an ego, and you also. So I think you're a little nutty if anyone who wants to be president
right.
in the first place, and then to have the whole conflict of power and powerlessness. And I think dreams are a good place to where those kind of issues would come out, even if they don't acknowledge it in daily life. Their dreams have got to be pretty weird.
Yeah. Did you start to dream about the presidents?
I don't think so. I'd like to say I did, but not really.
Let's talk a little bit about your work. You teach, and you work in mm-hmm. linguistics. You're a speech pathologist and mm-hmm. a writer.
Yeah.
I sort of presume that these occupations overlap. How do they work together in your schedule and your life? Is it hard to find time for everything?
It is hard to find time for everything. But I do a lot of my writing in the summer. I really, during the school year, I'm very busy teaching a course at UVM in linguistics, and I also work in Cabot School as a speech language pathologist, working with pre-K through 12th grade mm-hmm. children. And I have a lot of interest also. So I do some writing during the year. I do the bulk of it. Most of this book was written on Monhegan Island in the summer.
Mm.
At least half the poems were written on Monhegan. But I write all year round. But
do you have a certain amount of time that you spend there every summer, or was that just one time?
No, I spend a lot of time there with my wife Andrea,
yeah.
and we've been going every summer for many years.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of the book and a lot of my poetry in general is written during the summer, but I do write all year.
Okay, that's interesting. So many people say write every day. It's nice actually when you hear about someone who writes more cyclically and it still works out.
Well, I have a lot of things built up over the year that I want to write about.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd love to be able to write every day, but I don't have the time. And I know it doesn't sound very writer-like to admit that I don't write every day. But
I think it's more real.
For me it is.
For some people.
Yeah.
So your speech pathology work is in the school year.
Yeah, during the school year, yeah.
How much of what you write would you guess actually ends up being used in your poetry? How much do you think you're throwing away of first draft?
Well, it's hard to say because you don't throw things away anymore because you do everything on the computer. And it used to be that I would write and I'd throw probably 90% of what I wrote away because you keep ripping sheets of paper away. You wrote by hand. I would write by hand in the old days and then try to type it up and then make a change and then rip sheets of paper out of the typewriter and discard a poem entirely, so you're throwing it away. But nowadays, with the computer,
you just delete
and backspace and make changes and erase things and hit Control C and then Control V and you got it pasted and moved and pasted. So it's hard to say how much is thrown away these days, but certainly most of what I write originally doesn't make it to the final product.
Really?
I would say, I don't know most, but a lot of what I write, because I do so much editing.
Right. So is a lot of time spent on the revision?
Yeah.
Are you just sort of revising as you go?
I'm revising as I go, but then with these poems particularly, I went through them over and over and over and over to try to get them where they'd be publishable as a book.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw in your acknowledgments, it looks like you work with other writers, exchanging your work in a writer's group.
Yeah, that's been very important. We call ourselves Acme Poets, and it's a group of us who've been getting together for, let's see, over 20 years at this point, and I don't show any poems to anybody except my wife until they've passed the group scrutiny, and they're very helpful for revising and just little grammatical things and sometimes whole ideas, but they've really been helpful.
Yeah.
And we read each other's poems and just getting together and discussing poetry is such a treat.
Right.
And we've been getting together almost every month for over 20 years.
So once a month.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. How much of a formalist are you as a poet?
I'm not a formalist, but I do think that poetry should sound good. I'm very aware of... I can't tell if a poem is any good until I read it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not a formalist in terms of writing set forms or particular rhyming schemes or anything like that, but I certainly feel that poetry should be rhythmic, and rhythm is very important to me in general. And
language toys. But you don't seem to have a lot of rhymes going on.
No.
So there's some.
There's not too much rhyming, but I like alliteration. I like things to sound good. And I'm very... I try to get out any extraneous words that interfere with the beat of the poem. I can tell when I read out loud whether it's going to work or not.
Now, I noticed, and maybe this is a decision that you won't remember specifically making, but I noticed in one of the poems you had a line that you indented. And I didn't see that in a lot of the poems, and this was in Chester Arthur's Dream.
Hmm.
Now, maybe it's not something that you remember specifically doing, but I was curious...
Oh, I know what that was, yeah. Actually, there's a few poems where that happens. Robert Cleveland's Dream has one indented also.
Okay. Yeah.
Basically, because the line wasn't finished, but it was a new thought. And I think I was trying to have a little bit of space between stanzas,
mm-hmm.
but not a complete stanza break, because I wanted to have the line, each line should have a... It's not like an iambic pentameter. Each line has a certain particular rhythm, but I think each line is an integral part of the poem, and each line should sound good and should have a pleasing beat to it. And I think those indentations were basically a continuation of a line.
Okay. Now, I also understand that you write crossword puzzles.
Yes.
Right, so what's that like?
Oh, that's fun. You come up with a theme, or some puzzles are themeless, but basically you come up with a theme, and then you come up with... when I have a theme, most of my thematic puzzles involve puns and mm-hmm. They're kind of silly, but they're fun to write.
Who do you write puzzles for?
Well, I've had them in the New York Times, and I've had some Sunday puzzles in the LA Times and the Washington Post.
Uh-huh.
And,
so how often do you do that?
Well, I haven't written a puzzle in a long time now.
Because you've been working on the book.
in many months, because I've been, even now that the book's published, I just haven't had time to write puzzles. But I do, when I have time, I write a puzzle.
Now, I think you've been doing some author appearances, right?
Yeah.
I think I've saw. So you're still probably busy with the publicity?
I am. I'm trying to... I am trying to publicize the book. Great that you're having me on the radio, and that helps. And I'm trying to, like every writer, I'd like to get the book known. It seems to be, I've been doing a lot of things in Vermont, and I had some reading in Maine and New Hampshire and in Long Island, but I'm trying to get... some national publication to review it. I've had a lot of nice reviews in Vermont, and in New Hampshire, and a couple of small national publications, but nothing bigger.
Literary journals, or
no? Paste magazine had a good review, which I don't even know what Paste magazine is, but they're a national. I think they're a national kind of hip movies and books. They had a nice review.
That's great.
And there was a nice review in Manchester, New Hampshire, and Hippo Press, I think it was. And I've had nice reviews, but I haven't had a big national review.
Did your publisher send those to those publications?
They did.
They just find, okay.
Yeah. They did.
I wanted to just know what books are you reading now? What do you enjoy reading?
Right now, I'm reading a nonfiction book. I'm reading Oliver Sacks's book. Musicophilia.
Musicophilia.
It's a great book.
He's a very smart guy.
He is. And I'm interested in music. And I'm interested in music and the brain. I love anything about the brain, which seems more extraordinary to me the more I learn about it, and more mysterious to me the more I learn about it. And that's what this book is about.
Mm-hmm. Do you read poetry on a regular basis, too?
I like, Jane Cooper, who is a teacher of mine, is one of my favorite poets.
And Jane Cooper.
She died a couple of years ago, but I read Walt Whitman. I like Walt Whitman. I still go back and read Robert Frost, even the ones I've read over and over. I love Robert Frost. Denise Levertov, William Carlos Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And I also... read modern poetry, contemporary poetry when it comes out, but I go back to my favorites.
Yeah. What are you working on now? Or what will you work on next summer, I should ask?
Well, I've written a lot of baseball poems, and I continue to write baseball poems.
Yeah, now you had a collection of baseball poems?
No, I didn't. I was anthologized. I had about six baseball poems in it. Collection called Baseball, I Gave You All the Best Years of My Life.
Okay.
And there were six poems in six or so poems of mine in that collection. And I don't have a I'd like to come up with another theme like Dreams of the Presidents, but
I
don't know if I can
Dreams
do that.
Dreams of the Vice Presidents.
Yeah. Or the First Ladies or something like that. But I don't think that would be quite as interesting as Dreams of the Presidents, but mm-hmm. So I haven't come up with another theme like that, but I've been writing poems. I guess if I have any theme that I've been writing recently, it's been my mother has been ill, and I've been writing poems about her.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a subject that really takes a lot of people by surprise, and it's how you can express your feelings of grief, I think.
It is, yeah.
If not grief, then what you're going through.
Well, some of the feelings that also that... that I failed to express when I was younger to her. I think things are coming out now. Failed to express to her, but maybe failed to express to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a time when I'm learning things about myself and her that come out through poetry.
That's good. My last question for you is, as a poet, for other writers who might be listening, do you have any exercise or activity that you turn to when you're stuck in your work or a piece of writing refuses to move forward?
One thing I do, I mentioned music earlier, I get up and play guitar and sing, and it kind of puts me, when I play guitar and sing, it puts me in a transcendent state, kind of, and which is where I want to be when I write anyway, a kind of a free-floating, free-thinking state, and where I'm not encumbered by everyday thoughts. So playing guitar and singing puts me into that state again. So I find that just getting up and doing that kind of helps me get back into my writing.
So do you tend to do that before you'll sit down in a writing session, or do you mostly sort of get to a point where you're like, this isn't working, and then you kind of take a break?
I take a break, yeah, and do some singing. But I don't necessarily have to do it. When I first start writing, I generally have some kind of image in my head, and I'm very excited about writing, and I don't need anything to get started. I write basically from visual images, I think, that I have in my head.
Like Nixon wrestling. Brazil.
Exactly. And as I said earlier, if I think I know where I'm going, it doesn't work.
Right.
But if I just let the poem be itself, be the act of discovery, then it works much better.
Mm-hmm.
But if I get stuck and I'm not discovering anything, then I'll take a break and maybe play guitar and forget about the poem for a little while, and then get back to the writing.
Now that's something that the book Musicophilia probably will help us understand a little bit, is why is that tapping into that part of our brain that might continue the creativity that's maybe...
I think it has to do with rhythm again. I think... music is kind of a right hemisphere activity, and so is, I think, creativity and rhythm, and it's all tied together.
That's good. Well, thank you very much for meeting with me and talking to me today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Charles Barish. Next week, tune in again to hear an interview with literary agent Sorka Fairbank. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group, and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt is inspired in part by the interview you heard today. Charlie Barish said that when he has trouble writing, he sometimes sets his poetry aside and turns to music. His own instrument is the guitar, and he'll spend time singing and playing songs in order to jumpstart his brain and motivate the words to flow once more. Oliver Sacks, in the book Musicophilia, writes, "Given the obvious similarities between music and language, it is not surprising that there has been a running debate for more than 200 years as to whether they evolved in tandem or independently, and if the latter, which came first." He also says, "We humans are a musical species no less than a linguistic one. This takes many forms. All of us, with very few exceptions, can perceive music, perceive tones, timbre, pitch, intervals, melodic contours, harmony, and perhaps most elementally, rhythm." Maybe this explains why when Charlie Barish takes up his guitar, he's able to break through the occasional obstacle of writer's block and free up his creative capacity to write poems. Here is your assignment for the week. If you're stuck in your work or unable to start writing, stand up out of your chair, close your eyes, and sing a song. Not all of us can play the guitar, but most people can pick up the nearest object and tap it with a pencil. Sing a favorite tune by Sinatra, The Clash, The Talking Heads, Van Morrison, Tommy Dorsey. If you're so moved, dance around the room. Don't feel silly. Do just exactly what you might enjoy musically all by yourself without being told by an inner critic to stop. Play Once in Love with Amy on the piano. Hum Gershwin, whistle Mozart, or just clap your hands for a while in a rhythm that is recognizable or somehow moving just to you. Then return to your work and see what might have changed since that moment when you turned to music for help. Write for at least half an hour and see if you've made progress. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. A couple of the emails that I have gotten in the past have asked about the music that I play on the show. The opening piece is by the Australian artist, John Fink. The piece is called Dreaming One, and it's from his Uneducated Stream of Consciousness. The piece at the end of the show is called Filter. It's by a local band called Dorset Greens, which is made up of high school students from South Burlington, Vermont. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next at 10 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.